I next met with Dr. Eileen O'Reilly, and to begin, we touched on the issue of advanced pancreatic cancer, in this case, in an elderly man in her practice.
So this is a 79-year-old gentleman, actually a native of Florida, who came to New York for his treatment. And he presented with jaundice and some epigastric pain and weight loss, underwent a workup and identified to have a locally advanced unresectable pancreas cancer with pretty extensive portal venous involvement and no overt metastases. So a functional gentleman, no major medical comorbidities. He walked several miles each day, retired but active.
Motivated?
Motivated, very motivated. And he absolutely expressed the opinion that he wanted to undertake a treatment course that would give him the best long-term outcome and was willing to accept some treatment-related discomforts as a trade-off. And that was actually a key part of the discussion as to what treatment choice we would choose for this gentleman. So his only comorbidity that ultimately didn't influence treatment was that he had some hearing loss and somewhat significant hearing loss. So the discussion was he a candidate for combination cytotoxic therapy? And he clearly was. And would FOLFIRINOX be a reasonable choice? Or would gemcitabine-based combination be an option? And this is about 2 years ago now. So nab-paclitaxel was not FDA approved, was at the tail end of clinical trials at that time. But we did have access to that choice for this gentleman. And a decision was made to pursue dose-adjusted FOLFIRINOX. And by that, we opted to preemptively reduce all components of the regimen in terms of irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and modestly the infusional 5-FU and leucovorin, recognizing that there's no consensus as to what is the right FOLFIRINOX adjustment to be made in this setting. Some people feel very strongly that full dose treatment and supportive care thereafter. Our group is of the opinion that preemptively, modestly reducing the dosing is in line with what was ultimately reported in the phase 3, and that the median dose intensity was 80%. So that was our starting point for this gentleman.
Now, it sounds like he was not even a potential candidate for surgery. Is that the case?
Correct. So he had extensive portal venous SMV involvement, protracted tumor contact, and it seemed unlikely that even with treatment that this was going to reverse, but that was certainly from the patient's perspective an understandable hope and goal.
What are the common situations where you really can, you know, target the possibility that with a tumor response, the patient might be able to go to surgery?
So the context would be in this sort of entity of borderline resectable pancreas cancer. And the two extremes, we can all sort of clearly distinguish those that have clearly resectable disease, where you see a fat plane around the artery and there's no significant venous involvement, where upfront choice includes direct to surgery. And then those that have clearly unresectable disease, where there's arterial encasement of the celiac or the SMA, or sometimes the common hepatic artery. And then the borderline resectable group is that in-between group. It's usually mostly venous involvement, but sometimes can include a degree of arterial involvement, where the probability is that if that patient were to undergo resection up front, they would have an R1 resection. So by definition, borderline resectable in terms of its true sense means that the patient is resectable up front, but again, likely to have at least microscopic residual disease and possibly more depending on the extent of vascular involvement.
So you've reported on this issue of neoadjuvant therapy of pancreatic cancer. And of course, now it's 2 years later, but before we hear what happened to this man, what do we know today about the responses that are seen in the neoadjuvant setting to FOLFIRINOX, modified FOLFIRINOX, you know, NAB-GEM that you mentioned, and other regimens?
So I think increasingly we're seeing and recognizing response in primary tumors. You know, traditionally it was thought that, well, you don't actually see response in primary tumors and it's easier to assess in metastatic sites, and that's true. But I would say now that with combination cytotoxics, radiologic disease regression can be identified. The harder part, though, is where there's vascular involvement in terms of adjudicating following treatment, whether it is significant enough that a patient can get a negative margin resection, which is the oncologic goal. So here, I think some of these are sort of judgment calls. You know, if the patient has clinically responded, their pain has got better, their marker is normalized, but you still have this fuzziness against the vein or the artery, and it's a judgment of whether it is worthwhile to proceed with an attempted surgery or not. So for combination cytotoxics, FOLFIRINOX and gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, the response rate data comes from metastatic disease. Increasingly, both those regimens have been studied in the localized pancreas cancer setting, and we know that response rates are probably around 30% for these combinations and a higher rate of tumor marker response. So it is real, and I think there is a definite sense that true downstaging can occur with multi-agent cytotoxic therapy in the preoperative setting. And we know that a proportion of patients that have been deemed unresectable, that a proportion of those go on to be able to be resected following combination cytotoxic therapy and sometimes with the inclusion of radiation therapy. So it's hard to say exactly what that number is because it's heterogeneous groups of patients included in usually single arm non-randomized trials and single institution experiences. But the guesstimates are maybe 10 to 30% of patients, that may be a little generous, that latter number, with locally advanced disease may be at least theoretic candidates for surgical intervention.
I'll ask you the same question as it relates to metastatic disease in terms of the two regimens that oncologists talk a lot about nowadays, which is FOLFIRINOX and GEM-NAB. We only have indirect comparisons. What do the indirect comparisons say, and what's your sort of gut instinct?
Yeah, so a very topical issue, all right, and one that we discuss every day with patients is why one versus the other. So I think, you know, both have shown that compared to single agent gemcitabine, improved tumor response, improved disease control, and improved overall survival. The numerical outcomes in terms of median survivals favor FOLFIRINOX, but I think one has to respect that these studies were conducted in somewhat different patient populations. FOLFIRINOX in ECOG 0 to 1 in a solitary country, and the gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel in a somewhat broader community and academic-based settings, including somewhat lower performance status patients in that proportion of people had a KPS of 70, so some ECOG 2 patients, and that there wasn't an upper age limit, which there was in the FOLFIRINOX. And we certainly know that pancreas cancer is a heterogeneous disease and that there may be enough variability in different patient populations to have a significant impact on what may seem like an obvious difference between the two regimens. The U.S. Oncology Group have provided some interesting data from their registry suggesting that in equivalent populations, again, not in a randomized study, that FOLFIRINOX fares favorably compared to gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. But again, there's no direct head-to-head comparison. It was presented at ASCO as a poster. And so I think to speak to that continued topic, a lot of it too depends on what toxicities are acceptable to patients. So some people have very strong preference that alopecia is not acceptable to them. And that might be a reason we might favor FOLFIRINOX, all other things being equal. Some people are hesitant about ports and infusions. And I think these are all reasonable and appropriate things to consider. The other factors from the tumor perspective that might sway is a little bit, at least on my part, a little bit more lenient in terms of the bilirubin for FOLFIRINOX, given that one can typically start with FOLFOX or reduce the irinotecan dosing if somebody's been stented and their bilirubin isn't quite down. Whereas I think there is a little, at least theoretic, more concern with nab-paclitaxel in terms of liver dysfunction. But both of those are very qualitative statements.
So maybe you can talk about what happened with this man. Looks like he had kind of an interesting course.
So he did. He went on to receive dose-adjusted FOLFIRINOX with pegylated filgrastim support. We gave that every other cycle and did really pretty well and maintained a good functional status, had no hospitalizations other than an episode of cholangitis during treatment. So then our discussion was his response appeared to have plateaued. He was starting to get a little neuropathy. And was there any possibility that he could go to surgery? Again, that seemed unlikely, but it was an important goal from the patient's perspective to be fully optimized in terms of chances. So our decision was to include chemoradiation. And he went on to receive gemcitabine as a radiosensitizer along with radiation. That was 5.5 weeks treatment, IMRT-based therapy, 50-40 gray. And about 2 days before he was due to end, he started to get fevers and pretty high fevers of 39, a cough, and some shortness of breath. And that prompted a workup, and he was identified to have presumed gemcitabine-related pneumonitis.
What did his CAT scan look like?
Not good. So he had patchy, significant bilateral infiltrates. His O2 saturation was about 94% at rest, but desatted to the low 80s with minimal exertion. And the cough, actually, and the fevers were the symptoms that were most problematic for him.
What kind of workup did you do?
So the initial workup was to exclude the fact that there was an infectious etiology with the high fevers and nothing cultured out. He was treated with broad-spectrum antibiotics. Our pulmonary colleagues were actively involved and he was hospitalized at this point. And, you know, it's a diagnosis of exclusion in terms of drug toxicity, but certainly that was the high-probability diagnosis here. And he did not, but there was discussion about this, of undertaking a bronchoscopy and considering a transbronchial biopsy, but his respiratory status had actually gotten more tenuous and he was transferred to the intensive care unit at this point and treated with steroids in addition to broad-spectrum antibiotics. And within 24 hours, his fevers had resolved and he had steady improvement. He was not intubated and didn't require other than supplementary oxygen support. But, you know, this was a good grade 3 event.
How nervous, if at all, were you about the diagnosis without tissue?
I think pretty confident about this. We've certainly seen it and it's a differential to keep in mind in terms of cough or shortness of breath. If you think about it, he had low exposure to gemcitabine and data has suggested that it is not dose-related. He had, you know, probably the equivalent of 3 single doses because of the radiosensitizing dose that we were using. And I think we were pretty confident about the diagnosis and certainly with the quick response, which, you know, you can see with steroids, that also I think was reassuring in considerations in terms of atypical infection, like Legionella, in terms of mycobacterial infection, in terms of pneumocystis were, you know, high up on the list of things we actively needed to consider and exclude. But he probably had about 2 weeks in the hospital and has had a complete recovery, but you know, clearly this is a worrying toxicity and further gemcitabine would be contraindicated for him. We have institutionally, this is in review at the moment, we have put together our own experience. It's about a 1% incidence of pneumonitis. Fortunately, we did not have any mortality, but certainly mortality has been reported for this diagnosis. And I think there would be a serious risk with rechallenge.
So what happened to him?
So subsequently, he's been followed off treatment, and this is now 2+ years later. He remains a very functional gentleman following his recovery from the pneumonitis, and his notable clinical course has been several episodes of cholangitis. And that has proved to be perhaps the more difficult problem. He's had no progression of his cancer and has continued to travel back and forth to Florida. So in relative terms, I think a favorable outcome. We would like to have a better answer for his biliary issues, but that has proved challenging.
I was going to ask you before, when you mentioned he had cholangitis during the FOLFIRINOX, was that during a time he was neutropenic?
No, he was non-neutropenic. In fact, with an older gentleman and just our wish to specifically avoid that, We gave every other cycle pegylated filgrastim support, which isn't our usual practice, but concerns that he might not weather that type of toxicity well.
Do you ever put these patients with recurrent cholangitis like him on just chronic antibiotics?
We do. In my opinion, it's not been such an effective measure because it's a mechanical issue, and we suspect he has some degree of underlying chronic liver disease. That's part of the reason that he hasn't had effective drainage. And it's not that he's jaundiced, he's not been, but his alkphos and his transaminases to some degree have remained persistently enervated, and he's on a sort of an endoscopic cleaning out, if you would, procedure to try and preempt these episodes. I think antibiotics are an option, but in my opinion, if it's a kind of a drainage issue, it's probably going to break through that. And we haven't chosen that strategy, given that they've been infrequent enough thus far.
Can you talk about the recent data looking at liposomal irinotecan and pancreatic cancer?
Yes, so the NAPOLI-1 trial was presented at the World GI meeting in June, and this was a phase 3 study that looked at liposomal irinotecan combined with infusional 5-FU and leucovorin and compared to infusional 5-FU and leucovorin. And the eligibility were interesting, so this was a very pragmatic study, I would say, in terms of its design. Patients had to have at least one prior gemcitabine-based regimen. So that could have been first-line treatment for metastatic disease. It could have been a neoadjuvant regimen. It could have been a frontline treatment in the locally advanced disease setting. And the bottom line was that there was a survival benefit for the addition of irinotecan, or liposomal irinotecan, MM398, compared to the control arm. We're still waiting the sort of detailed breakdown of who actually benefited and were there subgroups within those broad inclusion criteria. One wonders, was it people who hadn't had irinotecan? Was it people who just had one line of treatment? Or was it a sort of a broader benefit across those subgroups? But I think from perhaps the FDA perspective, this may pose some challenges in terms of seeing where this drug would fit. But I think from a very pragmatic patient perspective, there was a clear difference. Didn't appear to be explained by any toxicity issue, in that, you know, one of the, I guess, the potential virtues of liposomal delivery is maybe more drug but less toxicity. Maybe it's just more drug. So the toxicity profile appeared fairly similar to what you might see with irinotecan in terms of its parent form. So I think we're hopeful that this may add a drug. I think it'll be an option. I think hard to see that it might replace currently available therapies, but may offer an additional option in a previously treated disease setting.
So let's talk about another one of your cases, your 51-year-old lady.
So this is a lovely lady who has had a long history of inflammatory bowel disease and had an end stoma for management of that in the context of a total colectomy. And she presented in 2010 with increased elevation of her LFTs. She has had some chronic LFT elevation in the context of mild sclerosing cholangitis and was identified to have an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. So as a known risk factor for developing this, and she went on to have surgery and had a just under 3-centimeter tumor. It was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma, negative margins. There was no vascular invasion and no satellite lesions, and did well postoperatively. And we actually met with her at that time to weigh out the pros and cons of whether or not to consider adjuvant therapy.
When you considered that with her, what was your assessment about her untreated prognosis?
So she was fit, she was well, and certainly would have tolerated any treatment. The factors that made us ultimately, after discussion of the pros and cons, elect to observe was that she had a relatively small tumor. It wasn't poorly differentiated. There were no satellite lesions, no vascular invasion, and negative margins.
So can you come up with a risk of recurrence in that situation?
Probably it's about 40%. Plus minus, so it's not tiny. And as we know in multiple other diseases, we would certainly recommend adjuvant therapy for that risk. But here the issue is that we don't have clear data that would support this. And we hopefully will have some data in the next year or two as several phase three trials mature in the adjuvant setting, looking at resected biliary cancers and post-operative adjuvant therapy. Some have a control arm of no treatment. One is a control arm of capecitabine. So I think those data likely will support the possibility that adjuvant treatment does add here. And the best data we have, short of randomized phase three prospective studies, is a large analysis from Jennifer Knox and her group that suggests that adjuvant treatment may add for resected biliary cancers, but always it's been hard to interpret because it includes intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, which is a very different disease to extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, different disease to gallbladder cancer in terms of patterns of failures and perhaps prognosis. And always this discussion of all the biliary cancers being lumped in one study and what's been done retrospectively and whether it should be consideration of systemic therapy or whether radiation should be included. So it's been a very, I would say, heterogeneous populations in the past. The SWOG group, Joseph Ben-Edgar at ASCO this year, presented the results from the SWOG adjuvant trial for patients with either a margin positive or a node positive extrahepatic biliary cancer, so either extrahepatic cholangio or biliary cancer. There was no randomization, but it was a quote-unquote experimental arm of gemcitabine and capecitabine followed by fluoropyrimidine-based radiation. And there, the median survival was well in excess of 30 months. So that's, I think, a current study that will likely provide the reference arm for a future randomized phase three in North America. But we certainly strongly need prospective data to better guide decision-making here.
In what situations right now outside a trial setting will you use adjuvant systemic therapy and or radiation therapy, and what kind of systemic therapy?
Yeah, so it depends on whether it's an intrahepatic versus an extrahepatic biliary cancer. I think, again, the intrahepatic biliary cancers are a little different, but general for node-positive disease, for margin-positive disease, for lots of satellites, for significant vascular and or perineural invasion, those factors would sway me in favor of considering adjuvant treatment. The mainstay being systemic therapy, but this is also a big question, whether to include radiation. And I think it goes back a little bit to what the patterns of failure of the specific disease might be. So for the most part, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, usually margins are not the issue. Usually, not always. And there, feel less convinced that radiation has a role. But for extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, I think margins are usually very challenging and often, while maybe technically negative, very close and or positive. And I think there is a role for adjuvant radiation. Again, it'll be nice to see prospective randomized data to support this statement, but I think it is likely that the data will support the use there. For gallbladder cancer, I have an open mind. The patterns of failure are different and typically more metastatic and more peritoneal for gallbladder cancer. And in the absence of positive margins, it has been our group's practice not to routinely think about the inclusion of radiation for those patients outside of a study setting.
What about choice of systemic therapy?
Yeah, good question. And no consensus here. We have adopted, rightly or wrongly, the SWOG regimen, which is gemcitabine given on a day 1 and 8 cycle, and capecitabine days 1 to 14 every 3 weeks. And that regimen is a total of 4 cycles. That regimen does include capecitabine-based radiation, but we more selectively incorporate outside of a trial setting the use of 5-FU-based radiation, depending on whether it's gallbladder versus extrahepatic versus intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma.
So this lady did well for a couple of years, but then unfortunately it looks like she had a recurrence.
Correct. Developed an adnexal mass that was identified on surveillance imaging along with a slight bump in CA99. And so after discussion, went ahead and had surgery, had no gross peritoneal disease, did indeed have a metastasis involving one of her ovaries. Both were taken out. And washings, you know, obvious fluid, but washings did demonstrate peritoneal cytology. So That was uncomfortable, suggesting that the probability was that she was at risk for peritoneal disease. So given no systemic treatment up front, her decision at this point was to recommend systemic therapy. And given biopsy-proven metastatic disease, she was treated in a pseudoadjuvant setting here with cisplatin and gemcitabine, analogous to the Valley paper from the New England Journal of the standard combination of metastatic disease. Tolerated that well and had about another year plus minus of absence of recurrence. And then more recently has identified to have both lung and mediastinal disease. So sort of interesting that she hasn't actually recurred, at least overtly yet, in the abdominal cavity.
So how's she being managed right now?
So we've had a discussion, and this is another topical area in oncology, the fact that there may be some interesting targeted treatments emerging that have relevancy for cholangiocarcinomas, and in particular, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. So we've opted to go ahead and take additional tissue for genomic analysis to evaluate for an IDH mutation. They occur with some frequency, maybe 15 to 20% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. And there are now some experimental therapies that are evaluating IDH mutations.
So when you say IDH mutations, so what kind of agents work against that? And I'm trying to remember where I've heard about it. Is that the same thing you see with GBMs?
Yes, exactly. So glioblastomas do harbor IDH mutations, and the other areas in acute leukemia. And
right,
there's been some very interesting data in refractory leukemias where responses have been seen. It's very early days, yes, in terms of biliary cancers, but there are studies, and one we're involved in, that indeed has a GBM arm, but also a cholangiocarcinoma arm, sort of in the dose escalation phase.
What kind of drug is it?
So it's a targeted agent that interferes with the mutation and can have a surrogate marker of AG that may be elevated and may suggest relevancy. And the other area in biliary cancers is occasionally you'll pick up a BRAF mutation. And in basket studies, we have some anecdotal experience that using vemurafenib may have some activity also in gallbladder cancer. And FGF-targeted agents are now coming to the clinic. And those changes are also seen in cholangiocarcinoma. So it's a disease where, you know, traditionally there hasn't been a lot of focus in drug development. And if we compare pancreas to cholangiocarcinoma, I think this, and often lump the two together in terms of therapeutics, but I think this may actually be a disease where there are targeted treatment, at least theoretically, opportunities. And we're now seeing more, and I think this is good, more drug development in this disease, and particularly with targeted agents.
You, I think, mentioned this lady's prior history, I guess in terms of inflammatory bowel disease, that put her at increased risk. What are we learning right nowadays about the risk factors for this disease?
Yeah, so it's a disease that is getting more common, and that may be partly the fact that it has typically been a diagnosis of exclusion and part of the unknown primary cancer entity. But I think now there's increasing confidence based on imaging, based on pathology, based on markers, I mean, both pathologically and serologically, that intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is a real entity. So risk factors are defined. Smoking is probably the biggest risk factor. Longstanding inflammatory bowel disease, in particular those with sclerosing and cholangitis, have an increased risk of developing cholangiocarcinoma. People with chronic liver disease, people with cirrhosis, people with chronic viral infections. So the risk for HCC, to some extent, are the risk for cholangiocarcinoma. And then, you know, the rarer things in the Western world, like aflatoxin and flukes exposure that we don't see much of, people who have longstanding intrahepatic cholelithiasis, and people who have congenital abnormalities of the biliary tree, again, rarely. But for most people, there isn't an obvious risk factor that's identifiable.
So I want to get your recent thoughts on a topic that I wish there was more going on. It's such an important tumor, hepatocellular cancer. And you were telling me as we were coming in here today that you saw somebody today with that?
Yes, indeed. And in fact, we had it as the subject of our resident teaching report this morning.
Great. So you already fleshed it out. So let's hear about this patient you just saw.
Yes. So he's another lovely gentleman from the Midwest this time who has a history of hypertension, diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, relatively mild, and NASH, for which he's been followed. And it was noted that his diabetic control started to get worse. He had lost some weight, some of it intentional, some of it not, prompted an ultrasound and identified to have a mass in his liver. And that prompted a triple phase CT. And he was appreciated to have stigmata of cirrhosis. He had splenomegaly, somewhat contracted nodular liver, but also had this large tumor sort of hanging off segment 7. And had what appeared to be tumor thrombus in his right portal vein and partly extending into the main portal vein. Multifocal disease, and he had Child's Pew B, his albumin down a little, mildly coagulopathic, small volume ascites, and decision was how would we approach him.
So is he a 7 or an 8?
He's a 7.
And how did he look to you in general?
He looked pretty well, so a high-functioning man. So it was a multidisciplinary discussion with interventional radiology, with our surgery colleagues weighing in, and with medical oncology. Firstly, was there any role for surgery? And clearly there wasn't. He had multifocal disease. He had main vascular involvement. Was there any role for transplantation? And he was beyond criteria for transplantation. So then it came down to a discussion of, is there any regional approach that makes sense versus is he better served by a systemic therapy? And a decision was made to consider arterial embolization, ischemic embolization, very selectively, given his liver function, given his stigmata of cirrhosis, and given his main portal vein involvement. And to be more specific, his bilirubin was 1.7, his transaminases were in the 50s, and his albumin was in the high 3s.
From your point of view, was he having symptoms from the tumor?
Yes, he had had weight loss that I think was likely related to this, and a pretty large burden of disease, and some discomfort. I would say the discomfort wasn't the big factor, but I think treatment was warranted, and his performance status certainly favored treatment.
You had a poster at the ASCO GI meeting earlier this year, embolization versus embolization plus systemic therapy. It looks like a retrospective analysis coming out of Memorial. What did you see there, and what's your overall take on this issue?
Yeah, so I think it's a sort of a very debated question, and no prospective data in terms of what's the role of regional therapies in addition to systemic therapy. And we have some sort of conflicting data. And as you know, embolization has been looked at with sorafenib in now 2 randomized studies, suggesting that the addition of systemic therapy to a regional treatment doesn't improve outcomes, despite the fact that there might be a nice rationale for combining the two. One of those is the prospective STORM study. We had this signal that there may, in fact, in selected settings and all the caveats of looking back and a heterogeneous patient population, that there may be in selected patients with advanced disease possibly a benefit to both systemic and regional treatment. But I think this is only hypothesis generating and clearly is a concept that needs to be more fully evaluated. I would say for the patient that we were discussing, there wasn't one clear right or wrong answer. He was at some risk from regional therapies, given his disease configuration, and perhaps not arguably a perfect candidate for sorafenib either, given that he fell within the Child's B range. So it's always a challenge, right? Just balancing the liver, underlying liver disease, and the cancer itself, and trying to tie in what would be the optimal treatments.
So what specifically did you recommend to him? And what did you actually see in this poster in terms of when you looked back at your own experience?
Right. So for this gentleman, in terms of the specific recommendation after multidisciplinary discussion, a recommendation was made for arterial embolization. And always this discussion comes up, should it be bland embolization or should it be embolization with chemotherapy? And lots of strong opinion data not clearly supporting either direction, except to say that there are two older meta-analyses which might favor the inclusion of chemotherapy. We actually at Memorial don't. We use bland embolization for its ischemic effect. That's what was undertaken selectively. He tolerated the procedure relatively well initially, but certainly experienced some degree of liver decompensation with a rise in transaminases and an increase in his bilirubin, went up to about 7. And then came down and a degree of coagulopathy. So just suggesting what we sort of already knew, that his liver was a somewhat sick liver, and a bigger embolization procedure he probably would not have tolerated well at all.
Did he have to be admitted?
He was. We routinely admit, and certainly for this gentleman, knowing that that was a concern and a risk, he was in the hospital for about 6 days, which is longer, typically about 2 days, maybe a third for some people. So he's safely gone home and his liver function, not quite back at baseline, but clearly trending downwards.
When you counsel a patient about this, if they were to ask you, or I'm sure you bring up, what's the chance of having a significant complication? I mean, maybe one like this one where you can manage it, but enough that I'm going to notice it. Maybe I'm going to have to be readmitted. In this kind of situation, what kind of a risk is it?
I think it's a very good question and something we have to be very upfront in our discussion. I would say the risk of a significant complication for this gentleman was probably, 15 to 25% range that he would have some negative impact. The other concerns, of course, being bleeding, being more overt liver failure and infection.
So you mentioned sorafenib as an option. Anything new in terms of systemic therapy? You mentioned the fact that he's a ChOLPUB. Anything new in terms of data on that kind of a situation? And how are you actually managing patients, particularly in terms of dosing?
Right. So it's a setting where we use sorafenib with greater caution because of the concern of, again, worsening underlying liver function. And it's an area that has not been so well studied. As you know from the SHARP study, that was the fit of the fit in terms of hepatocellular cancer with essentially ChOLPUA in good performance status patients. So here we would preemptively dose reduce and typically start at half the recommended dose. And in some, maybe even more cautiously, early follow-up and regular liver function follow-up. And advising patients of the risks of hand foot, of diarrhea, and fatigue and the risk of worsening liver function. So the other area that we would certainly like to consider in terms of these patients is trials. It's a challenging disease to conduct trials because of these issues of underlying liver dysfunction, but there's thankfully sort of a lot of focus on that area. And not least of all, providing an opportunity in a controlled way, perhaps to study drugs that are approved in other indications and learning in a liver dysfunction setting how they may work. I don't think it's exactly the same thing, though, for people who have underlying liver disease as opposed to people who have elevated LFTs for other reasons, maybe related to obstructive issues. I don't think they're exactly the same, but HCC, as I say, provides this sort of unique opportunity for drug development.
So last thing I want to touch on here in our discussion is neuroendocrine tumors, and your 44-year-old lady looks like a good case to kind of get into that.
Sure. So this is a lady who I've been looking after now for a while, who presented about almost 8 years ago with some right upper quadrant discomfort, and that prompted a workup and identified to have a head of pancreas hypervascular mass and multiple lesions within the liver. And she had a biopsy, and this was a well-differentiated but intermediate-grade neuroendocrine cancer and octreotide positive. And our initial discussion was, do we treat? And if so, with what? And then she, after sort of a discussion, we ended up recommending somatostatin, and she has received that for many years, and then experienced intrahepatic disease progression. She has no obvious extrahepatic disease.
Could I just go back to the original decision to use somatostatin alone? What were the key factors that you considered, and how reliable is grade in differentiation? You know, you're at Memorial. I'm not sure if it's the same thing out there in practice, but how much do you rely on that? And how did you think through her numbers or her presentation?
Yeah, so I think the pathology we think is very important. And this is an area where we often actually revise the pathologic interpretation on review of outside slides, because you're right, it is a complex area and I think needs expertise of people looking at it all day, every day. So the grading is important, and at least while it may not completely define the treatment plan, may define to some degree what the expected prognosis is. She was relatively asymptomatic, but had a relatively large burden of disease and had an exquisitely positive octreotide scan. And the idea of not doing anything didn't sit so comfortably. The idea of a palatable treatment, even though at least in the US it's a monthly injection, was a very acceptable treatment to this lady. And indeed, I think she had benefit. She did not have an obvious functional tumor, although serologically had some degree of elevation of both the serotonin and chromogranin, both of which came down, as you might expect, with somatostatin therapy. So that served her well for about 4 years. Hard, obviously, to interpret what the underlying natural history might be, but we know from the PROMID study, and we know more recently from the CLARINET study, that even in the setting of non-functional neuroendocrine tumors, that there does appear to be an oncologic value to somatostatin analogs. And so obviously we didn't have that data available when she started treatment, but I think that data is now available and I think provides reassurance for what's been done in practice for a while and what people have sort of believed.
So what was the next step?
So then with intrahepatic progression, a discussion of would we move to systemic therapies or regional therapies. And here it's, you know, a discussion of the fact that it might be a discrete intervention and certainly people don't feel well for the several weeks related to that. But the nice part of it is theoretically you're done and life goes on, as opposed to the chronicity of systemic treatments.
Can I just be clear, though, did she have disease outside her liver?
She did not. She had some small lymph nodes, but the bulk of her disease was in the liver. And, you know, guesstimate maybe 40% of her liver involved with disease, but, you know, fairly pristine liver function. Nothing that was amenable to surgical debulking or particularly made sense in terms of any surgical debulking strategy. She didn't have one sort of painful area, etc. So a decision was made to undertake hepatic artery embolization, and she had some disease regression probably for about 2 years. And then more recently, her disease has progressed again in the liver. And she's also started to develop episodes of what seem to be hypoglycemia. And we're still sort of in the midst of working this up as to whether she has an insulinoma. Certainly, hormonal profile did not suggest this previously. But it's required sort of very careful dietary management on her part in terms of small frequent meals, actually getting up at night to eat. And along with that, she has had hyperglycemia and was at one point on insulin, sliding scale along with metformin. And we initially opted to treat with everolimus, in the hope that that might actually increase her sugar and make these hypoglycemic, or at least presumed and documented sugars in the 40 on occasions, that might help that problem.
So you're thinking not so much the anti-tumor effect, but the metabolic effect of everolimus?
Both. So the fact that it does have an established oncologic value, more in terms of disease stabilization, low expected response rate, about, you know, 9% in terms of overt shrinkage, but that this might be a preferred choice over sunitinib, which was an alternative option, versus capecitabine and temozolomide, but that the everolimus might actually boost her sugars and make her less susceptible to these episodes of hypoglycemia. In fact, it really didn't, and it became more of an issue, at least seemingly, from the everolimus. So after about 3 months, her disease was fairly stable, but her blood sugars became more difficult to control. And this was with sort of careful consultation from our endocrinology colleagues.
How helpful is somatostatin with hypoglycemia?
Yeah, so it can aggravate it, and that's always a concern, the type 2 receptors, that for people who do have insulinomas, that they may actually get a paradoxical effect. I don't think we believe that that's what's going on, given her years of otherwise stability and the fact that this did at least temporarily get worse with the everolimus. It's still an issue, and her therapy has now been switched to capecitabine and temozolomide based on phase 2 data. And she's had some radiologic disease regression and certainly improvement in the swings in terms of her glucose. But I would say we're still struggling with the best management on that.
Are there any other supportive care or medications that can be used for the hypoglycemia?
Well, for people who indeed have insulinomas or are refractory to our oncologic therapies, a common thing that we do for these, you know, rare patients is put in a feeding tube and do nocturnal feeding to support them during the night when obviously it's difficult to be eating every hour, every 2 hours during the day, encouraging patients to eat frequently. We've selectively used IGF receptor inhibitors because of their hyperglycemia effect. And there's some case reports of that in insulinomas, and I have one personal experience where that was helpful. So I think on a compassionate basis, and we had one other patient who was enrolled on a trial of IMC at 12, which is an IGF-1 receptor inhibitor, not sort of undergoing further development, where this was probably helpful too.
So you had, you know, secondary reasons to use the everolimus here. In general, how do you sequence everolimus and sunitinib?
Yeah, so I think no consensus on this and a lot of discussion, and I think perhaps physician and patient biases and preferences. I'm a little more biased in terms of everolimus. I think the toxicity profile is a little nicer, but I know one can't necessarily say that from the phase 3 data, but I feel that for a lot of patients it's well tolerated. The fatigue is acceptable. The more problematic parts can be the mucositis, sometimes the fatigue for people, and the fact that pneumonitis is not an infrequent problem. And we certainly do see that requiring some pauses and some dose reductions and treatment for patients. Sunitinib, I feel the fatigue is a little worse, and maybe again my subjective opinion here, but that the mucositis and sometimes the myelosuppression is a little bit more complicated. But again, that's not based on hard data, and certainly they're both acceptable choices here. It's one of the big questions in the treatment of neuroendocrine cancer is there an optimal sequence and does it actually matter? So I think some studies will help answer this going forward. I think the other area where it'll be nice, particularly in pancreas neuroendocrine cancers where we know cytotoxic therapies have a role, is understanding from the Alliance trial about the added value of temozolomide to capecitabine in neuroendocrine cancer. And we'll likely have some data emerging before too long on that.
What's your clinical experience with that? What do we know about it? Your colleague across town, Dr. Fine, presented some data on this at the ASCO GI meeting. And what kind of regimen do you use?
Yes, so he indeed is a big advocate for capecitabine and temozolomide. So we have, you know, single institution, multi-center phase 2 data. As of right now, no prospective randomized phase 3 data. I think it is an active regimen. I think it's mostly well tolerated. And I've spoken to Bob Fine a lot and hear his thoughts on this. He is a strong advocate for splitting the temozolomide dosing. Our approach has been 14 days of capecitabine and day 10 to 14 on the temozolomide with prophylactic antiemetics for those several days. People tolerate it fairly well. I think it's not a bad regimen in terms of cytotoxics. But for some, the fatigue, the myelosuppression, and the hand-foot symptoms are more problematic. I think it is an active regimen. Certainly seen some nice responses and look forward to having sort of objectification of this. I wish in a phase 3 setting that's not imminently available, but at least we'll have some randomized phase 2 data for the combination before too long.
What about radiolabeled octreotide? It was studied a lot in Europe. I've heard that it's now available in the United States. Any experience with it? Would that be a consideration for this patient?
Certainly. So she had a very positive octreotide scan, and because of the availability issue, we've selectively been sending patients to, you know, to Basel or Rotterdam or Uppsala or Freiburg for this treatment over the years. It's not, I wouldn't say it's widely available yet in North America, but there are several studies in several areas, the group in Iowa, in Florida, our colleagues across the road, although I don't think they've actually enrolled patients just yet on a prospective study in carcinoid, and we're hoping at Memorial to have this in the not too distant future. I think we have a lot to learn. I think there are some concerns about the studies that have been done in Europe. Firstly, they're not randomized. Secondly, there's a choice of isotopes, very heterogeneous patient populations included in terms of understanding where this fits. It's pretty clear that there is some activity. I think concerns a little bit about the myelosuppression, about the longer-term renal implications. So I think we're hoping to repeat some of the studies and really sort of tease out where it fits and what's the best timing. Should this be something we're doing sooner in patients' disease, or just because of the access issue, traditionally for patients who have access to it from North America, it's been later in their treatment course for the most part.